Hello and welcome to Central Coast Voices, and thank you for listening to a little bit of Aretha. That was kind of nice driving in to chillax, to hearing her voice and dealing with freeway. Not an unusual thing, but certainly unusual here on the Central Coast. And we are addressing the ramifications of change and how today's choices will affect tomorrow's community. This program is an extension and production of Action for Healthy Communities and provided in collaboration with KCBX, made possible through underwriting by Joan Geller Sargent, and I'm your host, Chris Kington Barker. The 2016 election was marred by unprecedented disinformation campaign from sources both home and abroad. A recent survey showed that 66% of people asked believed that outside groups were actively trying to plant fake news stories in the mainstream media and that it was a serious problem. Since then, a central strategy of the current administration is a sustained assault on journalists and the news media. In an unprecedented response today, close to 350 electoral boards joined the Boston Globe in affirming their commitment to a free press and the truth. We are in for a lively show today as we talk about the role of media in our country and how it is under attack, why we should be very concerned, and what is happening. My guests for today's show are Michael Lattner, Associate Professor of Political Science at Cal Poly, and Kendall Roding, Voting Rights Fellow at the Union of Concerned Scientists in Washington, D.C. Kim Lassigore Bishop, journalist, author, and Cal Poly journalism lecturer. And joining us in a little while when he comes down the freeway is Dr. Rachel Beisel, is a professor and chair-elect of the Communication Studies Department at Cal Poly. Today's show is live, and we invite you to join us in our discussion with your thoughts, comments, and questions. And you can do that by calling us at 805-781-3875. Again, that's 805-781-3875. And I guess a good starting place is to talk about what is the media's responsibility in a democracy?
Oh, that's a great place to start. So first, thank you all.
This is Michael talking.
Yeah, this is Mike Lattner. The role of a free press and democracy is really one of, it's sometimes called the Fourth Estate. It is mentioned specifically in the Constitution in the First Amendment, the protection of the free speech and the prohibition of government to restrain free speech. And more so than that, when you think about the other branches of government that take up the first few articles of our Constitution, Congress and the executive and the judiciary, the design of our Constitution is one of separations of power, right? One of the things that distinguishes the U.S. from other constitutional systems is the way that power is diffused, and the logic there is that you don't want power concentrated in the hands of a single faction that can abuse it. But ultimately, I would argue, and I think that the text of the framers of the Constitution would back this up, the ultimate check on power in any democratic system is the people, because ultimately power lies with the vote and with the ability to hold leaders accountable. And leaders cannot be held accountable without a free press, because unless the press is doing its job in searching out truth and providing information that the public needs in order to hold leaders accountable, democratic government cannot work. And so ultimately, the press plays this crucial role, as important as any single branch of government, to maintain democracy.
The other, there's two branches right now that are under severe attack through this administration. One is the press. The second is the judicial system. Is there some commonality between those two?
And one might argue that the legislature basically gave up. So we have a sort of smoldering constitutional crisis, if you will. And the tactic here is not one. This is not an ideological attack. It's not even so much a political or policy-based attack. What the administration's doing is trying to insulate themselves from being held accountable, right? So if you think about the press as being, if it's their job to hold leaders accountable, and it's been said, you know, for a politician to complain about the press is like a captain on a ship complaining about waves. That's just, it's part of the game, right? So it is the job of the press, I think, to be adversarial. And the president and the press have always had an adversarial relationship. They know that it's adversarial, and most professionals respect that tension. This particular president is trying to insulate himself from accountability, and he's using a fairly well-known tactic among authoritarian leaders, and that is to use the press to both intimidate his critics, but also to silence opposition. And that's ultimately what we're seeing a reaction to today, I think, in the press. The leadership of the Boston Globe and all these other editorial boards around the country are taking the important step, I think, to remind the country of what role they're supposed to play. And that is supposed to be the search for truth and to hold leaders accountable.
So when we talk about, you know, we hear the term fake news a lot. And it used to be years ago, fake news was kind of what you would see at the checkout stand. You know, when you would go by and you'd read that, you see the horrendous pictures on the tag rag sheets, and you would read the articles that were just too bizarre to even be believed. Sure. And that seemed like obvious fake news, but it was entertaining and you could always put it back before you checked out. So what is fake news? I mean, what has happened with that?
Fake news as a concept is very old. Like you said, the supermarket check stand is where we may have first all been exposed to it. Since then, it's undergone quite a few evolutions. A couple years before the last election, believe it or not, is when fake news started its entry into the economic realm. There was a lot of money to be made in online news in inflaming people's passions and supporting their biases. If you print something that is false or exaggerated and it gives people a strong emotional reaction, then they're more likely to like it, retweet it, share it, and interact with it. And when you get lots and lots of clicks, you make lots of money. So that's when the fake news phenomenon started to emerge in the modern era. It's changed even further. You know, the term has kind of been co-opted. And over the past however many months, fake news, the term has come to mean news that may or may not be accurate, but which I do not like. And that's been a really dangerous evolution. It tends to undermine our trust in good information. And now people are just so darn confused, they don't know what to believe anymore.
Yeah. And I want to welcome our third guest, Dr. Richard Beisel, professor and chair-elect of the Communication Studies Department at Cal Poly. Welcome.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah. Traffic was a little bad today, so I apologize for being a little bit late.
Yeah, but you did listen to Aretha, right?
I did,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, well, welcome.
Thank you.
And we've talked a little bit about just kind of a basis of how news fits into the democracy. But talking about, you know, even before going into the election, people were playing with the news on electronic news media, social news media. And that's a really vulnerable place, is it not? I mean, you can do anything with it. Wikipedia, look at what, you know, even starting there from eons ago, you can make history any way you want it to be.
Yes, I mean, it used to be relatively easy to get reliable sources of news. You'd subscribe to your local paper, you'd subscribe to one or two national papers and national news magazines, you'd watch the nightly news, maybe some network news, and you had a reasonable amount of faith, and of course you'd listen to public radio, you had a reasonable amount of faith in the information that came from those channels. Now, we have all of these channels that don't have a gatekeeper. Anybody who wants to put information out there can simply push publish and it's out there.
Yeah.
And that makes us all very vulnerable.
Is the news media as biased as it seems? I mean, is it?
Well, it depends on what you mean by bias, right? So
yeah.
there are a number of variety of types of bias. There
yeah.
are There's gatekeeping bias, as was just mentioned, in terms of what actually gets on the agenda.
Yeah.
That can be biased. You can have coverage bias, which is really the magnitude of the amount of information that you spend on a particular topic. So, for example, if you watch MSNBC and Fox on the same, two screens, you'll see that one spends an inordinate amount of time on one issue versus the other channel spending, more of their time. And that tends to be ideological, between those two sources. But then there's also content bias, which is really the interpretation or use of evidence and facts to advocate a particular political or ideological.
Are news media outlets, for instance, publications like the Washington Post, or there's a presumption that they're left leaning or right leaning. Is that always so, or is it the news that they're producing that is left or right?
That's an interesting misconception. I think that people don't tend to understand the difference between editorial content and reported pieces that are done by trained reporters and opinion pieces that
can come from. Explain what you're talking about.
So newspapers have editorial boards that will publish opinion pieces. They don't necessarily reflect the feelings of the reporters on staff, their opinion pieces. People can write in from the public who do not work for those papers, and their opinions will be published on the opinion pages. Consumers used to have those sections segregated so that you knew you were reading an opinion piece because there was the big word opinion at the top of that section.
Right.
Now it's less so. It's all kind of, we get these pieces piecemeal through social media. And so it's become harder for the lay reader to understand when they're reading something that is an opinion piece or comes from an outside source or sponsored content, which is meant to look like a news article but is actually an advertisement. It's a really confusing place to be. So I think this notion of bias is somewhat skewed. It comes more from the leanings of the opinion pages than it does from the good fact-based reporting that journalists are doing when they're properly trained in journalism and ethics.
Would you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. This is not to say that there aren't real problems with the press and with the media. They just happen to have nothing to do with what the president is currently accusing the media of. So transparency is and honesty and uncertainty, trying to be accurate and doing the best job that you can as a journalistic organization is really important. There's a lot of pressure to move forward with stories before all the facts or evidence may be available. So there's a lot of commercial pressure, there's a lot of competitive pressure, but these are things that can be dealt with. And the media's got to do a good job. The press has to do a good job of playing the role that they have to play, which is fundamentally about searching for the truth. And a lot of the commercialization of media and entertainment and news has blurred these lines somewhat. And so particularly in terms of social media and television, you have an entertainment element that has become a growing part of what has been traditionally news, so that in order to seem like you're being objective, you want balance. And I think that's actually a mistake. The news shouldn't be about balance. It should be about truth. It shouldn't be about Coke versus Pepsi. Right. And there's a lot of that that goes on. I think that contributes to the public confusion.
There's a lot. It seems like on the social media, too, are people getting their news on their smartphones or on their computers as opposed to in a newspaper publication. There is also what you were talking about, which is being able to be tracked for the kind of news that you ascribe to, and then being targeted for more of that leaning toward the news.
We hear some things about echo chambers. How people on social media or in certain kinds of new media environments if you have a tendency to only select certain kinds of news, or if ideologically you have certain kinds of views, and you seek out that kind of information, and you seek out people who are kind of saying the same things over and over, you don't really have much of a chance to interact with other kinds of viewpoints, or to have an opportunity to take the information that you're getting and kind of putting it next to information that might disagree with it, and to think about that critically. So we don't want to have a sort of environment where people just end up reading the same kinds of things over and over. We want to have discourse. We want to have some kind of interaction between people with different kinds of ideas. So we've studied a lot of this stuff for a really long time with traditional media, the way that an agenda is set in terms of selecting certain topics and journalists report on those or not reporting on certain topics. We know that there are certain effects from how somebody says something, how they frame it, how they write about it. But with a new media environment, some of that stuff started to change. Now we want to find out what are the implications of that and how is that going to affect things. And I think some people, they see any kind of content that can be produced by anyone, and if it shows up in a feed or in my stream somewhere, that it must be just as good as anything else that is out there. Mm-hmm. And I think we want to be cautious about that. But that's also up to audience members to now think very critically about what is it that I'm reading? What am I seeing? And is this something that actually is true or not? Or is this something that is basically put out there for political or self-interested reasons? And we need to become better at filtering out some of that information.
Yeah.
We need to have more personal responsibility when we consume the news. The responsibility of journalists hasn't changed nearly as much as the responsibility of news consumers. We need to get much better at picking apart the pieces we see, especially through social channels, and vetting them.
Okay. Yeah,
that's a critically important thing where we have plenty of experimental evidence to show that one of the downsides of the democratization of information and technology is that people would rather reinforce the beliefs that they have than face information that would put those things in doubt, right? We like certainty. We don't like uncertainty. And so when there's a smorgasbord of information out there to choose from, the bias is going to be in the direction of information that reinforces your existing beliefs rather than challenges your beliefs. And that's a big problem, because democracy is supposed to work by a critical consumption of information and in a search for as close as we can get to the truth.
Yeah, I want to get back to that. This is Chris Kington Barker, and you're listening to Central Coast Voices on KCBX HD1 San Luis Obispo, KNBX HD1 San Arto, and KSBX Santa Barbara. Mainstream media is increasingly under attack as fake news. But what is fake news? Who decides? And what are the risks and consequences of the trends that we're seeing? And how do we become more responsible as consumers? We're going to be talking more about that in just a moment. My guests for today are Michael Lattner, Associate Professor of Political Science at Cal Poly, and Kendall Voting Rights Fellow at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Kim Lazagor-Bishop is a journalist, author, and Cal Poly Journalism Lecturer. And Dr. Richard Basile, is Professor and Chair-Elect of Communication Studies Department at Cal Poly. You're invited to join this conversation if you have some comments or opinions or questions for our guests today. You're invited to join us at by calling us at 805-781-3875. Again, that's 805-781-3875. And I want to get back to the idea of us being more responsible as consumers. I mean, what do we need to do? Because it's not going to be handed to us as a truth. So how do we vet that?
Well, you've got to be increasingly aware that you're in a competitive media environment where most people are trying to get you to pay attention to their information for commercial reasons, for ideological reasons. And one thing that comes out of some of the experimental evidence that's rather hopeful is that young people are actually better consumers. They're more accurate and they have better BS filters, I can say that on NPR, compared to older generations. And part of that is because they've grown up in an environment where they've been bombarded with information and people trying to sell them things all day long, compared to their parents and grandparents who grew up with three channels.
Yeah. Okay.
I would also say there's something with a little bit of self-awareness. We have a lot of studies out there that also show what we call a third-person effect at times, where sometimes we think that, oh, yes, there's a lot of influence out there and that there are all these kinds of messages, but it affects other people. It doesn't affect me.
Mm.
And I think one of the things that we need to do is to think really carefully. It's like, well, I need to process this very carefully, even though I know that sometimes these messages do have an effect on me. And so I think at least being aware of those sorts of things is one important step to being able to become a better critical consumer of these kinds of messages, that even though I know this thing is out there, it can still possibly affect me and in all kinds of interesting ways, and sometimes in ways that I'm not even completely understanding at the moment. So I think that third person effect is something that we need to be very, very aware of and very cautious about when we look at this, any kind of news feed or media that's out there.
Right. We also need to think more like fact checkers. Mm-hmm. We have to click on the story and actually read the story instead of just reacting to it emotionally and sharing after reading the headline. I know we're all very busy, but in just a few clicks, you can get a pretty good sense of how reliable something is as a source. You click beyond the headline, you see the URL, and you just do a little bit of thinking, have I ever heard of this news org before? If not, let's find out something about it. Who's behind it? You can find that out in minutes or seconds even.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes the chain can stop right there. And if we stop just immediately sharing these stories as soon as we react to them, if we just take a few seconds to look at the URL, to look at who is behind these organizations, to look and see if we read the story, if it even looks like journalism, then we're going to do we're going to make a lot of progress toward stopping the spread anyway.
What is the danger of all of this that's happening now? What is the danger? For instance, the situation. I was going to read one of the things that I thought was really interesting was some of the words that were printed off of the tweet that was done by Brennan yesterday after he was fired. Or after his security clearance was taken away.
Yeah.
It wasn't so much that his security clearance was taken away, but he was really saying, you know, this is a dangerous situation because this is really impairing free speech. This is really about not being able to speak a truth and having controls put on that. Is that something that we risk if people aren't stepping forward, aren't looking for the truth, as you're saying, and are immediately saying, yeah, that's fake, that's real, without vetting that?
Sure. Well, we are already seeing it. I mean, I think that there's at least two areas where we can demonstrate that there is an effect, and this isn't just of this administration. I mean, obviously, the Trump administration is not the first to attack the press.
And in fairness, Obama also had his issues with the press, too.
Politicians all have adversarial relations, right?
Yeah. We should worry about politicians who are friendly with the press.
Right. Yeah.
That means the press isn't doing its job.
Yeah, and Spiro Agnew referred to the press as the nattering nabobs of negativism. I mean, this is part of what it's actually a sign of a fairly healthy tension between the press and the branches of government. But we have not seen this sort of sustained attack.
Yeah.
And so what's unique, and I think the other guests can probably speak to this better than I, but you've had an erosion in trust in many institutions, but in the press as well, over the last decade or so. And part of this is, you know, for things we've already discussed, technological reasons and other reasons. But the political relevance of that is that if there are no trustworthy news sources, then it exacerbates this sort of fallback to trusting those who you're closest to. And so to the extent that the president, for example, is successful at convincing people that they shouldn't listen to the media, they should only listen to him and let him communicate directly with people, that relieves him of a great deal of accountability and empowers him in a way that he wouldn't normally be, that any executive would not normally be empowered.
I'd love to know if you two are hearing this from your students. I've heard other faculty members talk about students saying, you know, I've stopped reading the news. I've pretty much stopped engaging. Number one, because it's all fake, or number two, because I just don't know who to believe anymore. And so they've completely detached themselves from the process of bringing in news information to their lives.
And that's frightening, and I hear that from adults, you know, from a lot of individuals, if it's just overwhelming, I just don't want anything to do with it anymore.
Yeah, I hear that from a number of people as well. And I think there are a number of reasons why people are doing that. One of them is that there's so much out there.
Yeah.
It's become so easy to produce stuff and it's become so easy to access it that people are just overwhelmed with the amount of information and they have to figure out ways of coping with that or processing that that makes sense to them. And for some people, that's just unplugging and saying, I don't want to look at any of it.
Right.
For others, it's the emotional connection. They read things and they get upset by some of the stuff that they're encountering.
Yeah.
And so it's not that they can't filter. It's that they have positions where they disagree with some of the things that they're reading about.
Right.
And so that becomes a reason that some people decide to unplug or stop looking at things because they find it upsetting. So I think a number of people have different reasons for turning things off or tuning out. And I think it's just a matter of figuring out how do we kind of find ways of delivering news to reconnect with some of those groups of people so that we either teach them the skills that help them become better sort of thinkers about it and how do they filter through that much information. And then hopefully we can help people kind of see that there is an emotional connection to a lot of this stuff, but sometimes we still need to kind of see what's happening even despite that emotional connection. But sometimes that's hard to do.
Is it important for us to hear, you'd mentioned, you know, we tend to go towards information that fits with our own opinions. Is it important for us to hear other sides?
Oh, well, absolutely, it's important, but there, it's not clear that simply exposing people to information that they don't like is going to change their views. You know, there isn't
right.
necessarily a sort of regression to the mean that if I hear something from the extreme left and the extreme right, that I'm going to figure it out.
Go in the middle.
No,
yeah.
And in fact, there's some evidence that suggests that that hearing a lot of information that challenges your pre-existing beliefs will facilitate people withdrawing from the public sphere. And so part of the role that the press plays is mediating this information, right? It's one of the reasons
right.
why the press is so important, because they have traditionally played the role of not just filtering out bad information from good information and accurate information, but in providing a forum for people to have a meaningful civil dialogue.
Yeah.
And I think that that's a big piece that is missing as well, is that a lot of the dialogue that is out there is really just adversarial, sort of vindictive political. It's stuff that you're used to seeing in electoral campaigns.
I agree with that. I think a lot of my students today, when I have these kinds of conversations with them, I will ask them, how comfortable do you feel engaging others of a different opinion in kind mm-hmm. of like an open forum, right? And a lot of them, I think, feel like they don't have the skill set or the capability to even engage other people
yeah.
right.
who have a different set of viewpoints or just a different ideological position. So I think a lot of people today feel like they're not equipped to do something like
mm-hmm.
that, or it's something where it kind of intimidates them, and so therefore they don't participate in that at all.
Yeah,
there's so much emotion about it and mm-hmm. so much polarization and anger, and feeling like we're on opposite teams. We have
yeah,
to tribalize
yeah.
this.
Well, and I think that the media has to bear some responsibility
yes,
for this as well, right? Because
yes.
this is to watch two people scream at each other is a lot
right.
more exciting than
Well, that brings
a
up a good
debate.
Point. I think we have to be careful about how we use the term the media, because
yeah.
when we're
yeah.
talking about two people screaming at each other on CNN, that's very different than reading a fact-based article on the front
right.
page in the New York Times.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Right.
So I would actually encourage people to stop consuming news online, reduce the amount of cable news shows that they watch where people are yelling at each other, start getting print publications again. And there are lots of reasons to do this. One is that if you're looking at a physical newspaper on your coffee table in the morning, you can't overreact to it and spread anything without really stopping to think. You have to take those extra steps. Another one is that it's responsible journalism by people who have been trained and heavily vetted. Another one is that I think it's important for our kids to get to know name brand journalism. News consumption has become this very private process in recent years. We all stare at our phones and our kids don't know what we're reading. So when they're finally exposed to information online, they don't have that brand recognition that we grew up with.
And there's also something about the idea of the sort of the hard copy newspaper versus getting it online. If we see that in online versions, we have this sort of echo chamber effect, or we're only kind of seeing the stuff that is targeted to us or the
right.
things that we seek out,
right.
we get a much narrower range of topics and, mm-hmm. and exposure. So a few years ago, I remember reading a study that came out of Illinois where they tried looking for comparisons between the picking up the physical copy versus looking at it online. And when you pick up a physical copy and you're scanning through the pages, even if you see articles that aren't really of interest to you, you still see the headline. You still process something
right.
about it in a different kind of way from flipping through the paper. Whereas looking online, if everything is much more targeted and you can do a search and then only look for the things that
right.
you want to find or certain
or specific.
Or
you're
going to
see a single yes. article, whereas when you're looking
yep.
at a paper, you're going to see articles that would normally would not pull
exactly.
your eye and you wouldn't be attracted to, and you may learn something completely new.
Exactly. And,
yeah.
that, and there's something about that breadth of information mm-hmm. that also changes then. So our reading patterns and how we get that information,
yeah.
Some people have tried to argue also makes a difference in terms of what do you know and how engaged are you with the things that are going on around you.
You know, news media has been used politically in this country as well. How does the news media allow themselves to do that, and how do they get out of that?
Sure. Well, I mean, the whole idea that there is an objective press that somehow it's separate from the political process is something of a myth,
yeah.
or at least a recent development. The first newspapers in the United States were newspapers organized for political purposes and campaigns, typically presses that were owned by party or proto-party organizations.
Right.
So
it was all partisan press.
Yeah, I mean, it's and the idea that there aren't conservative or liberal views, whether it's in the editorial board or among journalists, is something of a product of a brief history of time, where the first mass circulation papers emerged about 100 years ago, and there was the notion that we're just going to print the facts that are fit to print. And what's more important, I think, is to recognize that journalism is a profession. And just like any profession, we are all citizens and we have political views, but that doesn't mean that we're not capable of impartial analysis. And that's what the job of journalism is about. And that's what that's why we need professional journalism.
Now, the work you've been doing, Mike, back in Washington, D.C., ties into some of what you have been seeing happen with this whole discussion around the media, just on a bigger scale.
Sure. Some of the work I've been doing with Union of Concerned Scientists has, over the last year, focused specifically on attacks on science. And so the attacks that we're seeing on the press are not separate from other attacks that we're seeing on essentially information. So this administration has a political agenda that does not that wants to be insulated from information, and they're doing everything that they can, not just to insulate themselves, but to discredit competing narratives in the media. And so they've done this institutionally by literally removing members of scientific advisory boards on some of the most important organizations, the EPA and other organizations, and by literally restructuring the organization of the bureaucracy so as to demote and de-emphasize the role of scientific scrutiny. And so these are all part and parcel of the same sort of tactic that we're seeing out of this administration.
And the problem is that, as I see it too, is that the media becomes complicit in that because they're not reporting on that aspect as broadly as...
Well, when you've got Omarosa's tapes to talk about, I mean,
exactly,
there really isn't room.
Exactly my point.
I think it's been reported on quite significantly. It just hasn't bubbled up to the top of your social feed.
Well, there's also this sort of like
this
strong desire to defend oneself.
Yeah.
The very notion. So when I teach rhetoric classes, argumentation classes, this very common strategy of the best defense is a good offense kind
mm-hmm.
of idea. And so fake news, and it's just the very way that it's used. A lot of times, somebody accuses you of doing something wrong. Well, no, you must have done something wrong.
Mm-hmm.
The person who is accused and accuses the accuser, and it puts them on the defense. And so now you have to say, no, I didn't. And it shifts the attention off of what was originally being reported.
Yeah.
So I think as this kind of discourse becomes increasingly prevalent, I think more people feel like that we have to talk about that, and that there has to be some kind of a defense. But then that also takes time and effort away from reporting on things.
From real things.
Exactly. And yeah. So there's something about that strategy that does work. It doesn't work all of the time, but the very idea of a good defense is a good offense kind of notion. I think we see that in a lot of different contexts, and there's something about those sorts of comparisons that might apply here with the idea of fake news.
Yeah, there are so many ramifications for some of the changes that have been happening under the radar that, you know, I think the average public really doesn't have an understanding of. And it hasn't really, it's been reported, but unless people are reading on page six,
right,
you know, in the environmental news or in business section, you're not going to see it. You're just really not going to get it. So what do we encourage reporters to do, or what do we as consumers do?
Well, I think one thing news orgs can do is be more transparent about the process, not just publish the story on page six, but keep telling us what we're doing and why we're doing it while it's ongoing. So Twitter is helpful in that, certainly not a perfect system, but you know, I encourage students to follow individual journalists who they admire. David Frum, David Fahrenthold, you know, whoever has writing that you think is responsible and admirable, follow them and really get to know the process. That's one step.
I would say you can also look for concurrence across the different sources that you're reading. Read multiple things. Mm-hmm. Don't just get it from one place and then kind of do some comparison. In terms of what news organizations can do, the commercial that I think aired on CNN is something that sticks with me a lot. It's the one that had the banana versus apple sort of thing.
Right. Yeah.
I can't remember what they said. And like, you know, someone might try to tell you that this is an apple, but it's actually a banana, or vice versa. I can't remember. But the fact that we have certain news organizations putting out commercials to try to say, hey, we're the ones who are going to tell you that this is actually what it is.
Yeah.
I think the fact that they're advertising or putting these sorts of things out there is pretty telling. I mean, that kind of gives you an indication of where we are today in terms of thinking about news and our news processes.
Do you think that's effective?
I don't know. I hope it is, but I've not seen any of the numbers and whether or not that's actually been effective for CNN or not.
I'm going to I was going to take a call, but I'm going to let Tyler get that. You mentioned too, and when I got some pre-work from you, the, you know, an example of something that's a concern is the changes in the 2020 census. Do you think people really understand the importance of that?
Yeah, well, so this is a nice example of the administrative attempt to use their political agenda and describe something in a way that that those who are experts in that particular area disagree. And so what we are now talking about in the press more often than not is whether or not non-citizens should be identified through the census when that is in fact not even the priority of what's happening, right? So the question with the 2020 census is whether or not there should be a citizenship question put on the census. We measure citizenship and non-citizenship through alternative surveys, the American Community Survey, the current population survey now. And the administration, the Department of Commerce, argued, Wilbur Ross, the Secretary of Commerce, argued, told Congress, in fact, that this was a request from the Department of Justice so that they could better enforce the Voting Rights Act. That turns out to be a lie. We now know from Freedom of Information requests that, in fact, the Commerce Department wanted the Department of Justice to ask this question. Wilbur Ross was asking about it months in advance. And so this is the public is having a conversation about should we or should we not have citizenship on the census when that's in fact not at all the priority of the administration, and they're moving forward with an attempt to reduce the count among hard to reach populations in an effort to change the data that we get from the census.
And the ramifications can be huge for states.
Massive. The census is the single most comprehensive and expensive project that the government undertakes other than going to war.
Yeah.
It affects the economy in myriad ways. It affects every data-based decision that we make in government and in most of the private sector. So it's extremely important.
And it's being, you know, when we talk about languaging and how things are put and how just a few words can twist something to make it look like something else, it's making it look like somehow it's tied to the immigration issue.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, it is tied to the apportionment process with the way that seats are apportioned to the House of Representatives. It's tied to a lot of political things, but it's not actually tied to actually improving our capacity to monitor non-citizens. It really has nothing to do with that because we've already got good methodologies to do that. And in fact, adding this question would reduce response rates in such a way that it would distort the data in ways that we can't predict.
Yeah. And the scientists are saying, don't do this.
Every director of the census has said this is a horrible idea. Experts inside the Census Bureau have explained to the Commerce Department that this is a bad idea, but the experts are not winning this argument. Mm.
We're going to take a real quick call from Jenny here. Jenny, are you there?
Yes.
Hi, you had a question or comment?
I wanted to encourage everyone to read the editorial in today's San Luis Tribune. It's a wonderful one talking about how, they're one of like 300 newspapers across the nation right now talking about we are not the enemy of the people, the journalists.
That's right.
Also, the danger now that journalists are facing in terms of threats and actual shooting. Okay.
Yeah, thank you, Jenny. She brings up a good point because there has been an escalation in the anger issue that we've talked about of people being able to have civil conversations or talks of discussions around things that they disagree on.
Well, and it
seems
it's,
to be reduced.
And it's become difficult for journalists to just do their jobs.
Yeah.
So when you see reporters going to certain kinds of events or conventions or where you might have a large gathering of people, for some of those folks who maybe don't have a very positive view of a certain network, if they see that that particular network is there, sometimes audience members might turn on a journalist just for covering what is happening there. And so that's something that we really need to think about in terms of how we treat journalists. They're people doing a very important job, and it's not something where we should go after those individuals or something like that. This is something that is not okay, and it's something that we have to be very, very careful about.
We saw that recently with
Jim Acosta on CNN.
Jim Acosta. Right. That was frightening.
Well, and that's just one piece that was captured, right? So you've got to think about the way that intimidation works, the way authoritarianism works, is not as though we wake up one day and we're an authoritarian regime. It's a process of intimidation. And how many reporters are going to expose themselves and their families to that sort of treatment if they know that that's what they face? And, you know, Lord only knows what Acosta sees on his Twitter feed.
Right.
I'm sure it's much worse.
Well, and what he was saying is that his family and he were threatened and there were a number of things that
this is where we are now.
Yeah. Right.
Every journalist in the country has that fear. Every journalism student has that fear.
We have just a couple of minutes, but I want to make sure that we get information out that you wanted to be certain to get on the table here.
Go ahead.
Richard?
Go ahead, Richard.
So I just wanted to make sure that listeners think very carefully and critically about the kind of information that they're getting.
Yeah.
Diversify your sources. Be very cautious about believing the first thing that you read if you have a very strong emotional connection to it. Look for concurrence. Read other sorts of things and make sure that you're getting it from the best possible sources that you can. So I really do want to encourage everyone out there to take this very seriously. Support journalists when you are able to do so, right? Obviously, don't attack them when they're doing their jobs. I mean, these are basic things that we shouldn't be doing. But definitely take responsibility upon yourself to make sure that you're staying as well-informed as you can be.
I appreciate it. And I want to thank my guests today, Michael Lattner, Associate Professor of Political Science, Cal Poly, Kendall Voting Rights Fellow at the Union of Concerned Scientists, Kim Lascor-Bishop, journalist, author, and Cal Poly Journalism Lecturer, and Dr. Richard Biesel, professor and chair-elect of the Communication Studies Department at Cal Poly. Next week, please join host Fred Monroe when he talks with representatives of ECHO, El Camino Homeless Organization. And Central Coast Voices is sponsored by Action for Healthy Communities and the San Luis Obispo Community Foundation in collaboration with KCBX and made possible by Joan Geller Sargent. I'm your host, Chris Kington Barker. Thank you for joining us.